All right, welcome everyone. This is a great group. It's good to see you all here. So you are here today for our panel discussion, Progress in Stopping Sexual Assault, Public Outcry and Finding a New Normal. This is one of our One Book, One College panels. So it's tied into our book, We Believe You, which is a book about stopping campus sexual assault. And when we planned this book back in last spring, we planned this with the counselors on campus, and we could not have imagined then that the conversation that we wanted to have, which is survivors, we believe you, and we want to hear your stories and your voices, that would become a national conversation. But as we will discuss this fall, it really became a highlight that the media has highlighted. We've been talking about it probably in your classrooms, among your friends, in the national news. So we wanted to have a deeper conversation about it today. A few notes before we get started. My name is Tish Hayes. I'm the librarian here, or a librarian here. The librarian. And I'll be moderating the panel, but most of these people will be doing the talking. If at any point during our conversation today you feel uncomfortable, you need to step away, please feel free to do that. If you would like to talk to a counselor, we do have a couple of counselors on hand. If you can raise your hands, counselors. Oh, there you are.
They have a table.
They've got a table over there, so just feel free to grab one on your way out, or you know, walk over to the counseling center later today if that is something that you'd like to do. So before we jump into questions, I'd like my panelists to introduce themselves, and then we'll get started.
Morning, everybody. My name is Mary Fifflis. I teach history and political science, and as of 12:30 this afternoon, sociology, too. And I'm also the college's study abroad coordinator.
Hi, everyone. My name is Kevin Navratil, and I am a professor of political science, and I'm also the Democracy Commitment coordinator.
Good morning, my name is Amy Williamson. I am a psychology professor, and I also am a clinician who has worked for the last 25 years with survivors of trauma, which includes a lot of sexual assault stuff.
And I'm Amanda Mezra. I'm the coordinator for Code of Conduct, and I'm also one of the Title IX investigators on campus. So Title IX is the sexual discrimination harassment misconduct policy here at Moraine, and the federal laws with that as well.
So we have a lot of experts on our panel. And before we get started, I wanted to frame this discussion with a few statistics. So we know that sexual assault and harassment has been in the news a lot recently, really high profile cases. But to understand those cases and to, I think to talk about them and the way what they mean to us in our cultural context is to kind of see where our statistics are around rape. So real quickly, up on the screen, you can see that an American is sexually assaulted every 98 seconds. That's really frequently. Those are some numbers there of who is sexually assaulted. And we often, I think there's a narrative, especially on TV, of sexual assault happening in a dark alley. It's terrifying, there's someone has a gun to your head, but that's not the reality. The reality is that most rapes occur by someone that you know. And most of them happen in victims' homes, or so places that they would normally feel safe. College-age women are at risk, and not just women who are at college, but all college-age women, whether they attend college or not, are at higher risk than other age groups. And college-age men are at risk much more than other aged men. So one of the things that we hear about a lot, especially in these huge conversations, national conversations around rape, is that, oh, well, women lie about it. Oh, she's not telling the truth. There's all of these false accusations. And that's just not the case. So you see all of the statistics here are shown in this kind of nice graphic. They're rapists. Some of those rapes are reported. Some of those rapists face trial, but very few. Only a few go to jail for their crimes. And then down here in the bottom corner, you see two little people. Those are out of this huge map, two people who might be falsely accused. So it's a really small percentage. The fact is that rape is underreported. So even though we have like lots of great statistics that you know talk about how often women are raped, or including men as well, the actual numbers are probably significantly higher compared to things like burglary or other crimes. And although all of the attention recently in the media has been on,
Film industry,
right, thank you. Actually, rapes happen in all industries and the most in accommodation and food services. So just last night I was reading about 60 women coming forward against Applebee's and IHOP. And so those jobs that young women often have, trying to get through college, that's a place where you're gonna see rape happen. So that's some context, and we'll come back to the slides in a few minutes, but I wanted to get the conversation started by looking at these kind of high profile cases. So the Harvey Weinstein case was broken in October. Jody Kantor and Megan Chewy broke this in the New York Times. Additional women came forward, and for a few weeks it was just like, you know, every single day there were more accusations, and it was huge. And I think for at least a couple of weeks, we were all like, oh my God, how could this have happened? How could someone have been abusing his power so blatantly and this not be reported, or he couldn't face any consequences? So the first question I'd like to put to the panel is, you know, what is your perspective on this? You know, why do we allow, or why do you high-profile people often get away with rape?
Sure, I can start. Part of it is the way power functions in our society, and people who have power get away with a lot more things than the rest of us. excuse me. Secondly, there's a lot of psychological barriers or structures that keep people from reporting these kinds of things. One is shame. I mean, there's a lot of shame involved when you're harassed or assaulted. Self-blame, you think that maybe you did something wrong, that there was some reason why this happened to you. And the culture reinforces that by saying things like, well, why were you out at 2 in the morning, or why were you wearing that, or you should have known this would happen, you know, and kind of those kinds of comments reinforce the idea that the victim is somehow to blame. Some of the other things, just, you know, humiliation of having it happen, that it's a humiliating experience to have somebody assault you or harass you or touch you in a way that you didn't want. And I think the self-blame part is really big. People think that somehow they did something wrong. And we have to really flip that script, because that's a big part of the problem, why a lot of women don't come forward. And, you know, I think we continue to have this discussion. I think this is an important discussion, because those are the things that we need to change. It's a cultural shift that really needs to happen. The other thing is fear of repercussions. I mean, a lot of women are in a double bind. You've got women who, you know, maybe they need their job to support their family. And so it's like, well, if I just blow this off, you know, I get to keep my job. If I speak out, I may lose my job. And then what? And then, you know, people don't necessarily like to hire people who were terminated for reporting sexual harassment. I mean, there's so many variables that keep people quiet. I think it's a really difficult choice for women to make when they do come forward.
And I agree with what Amy said. And part of what we see on campuses with students is that even revealing the fact that you have been assaulted or harassed or abused, sometimes that means you have to reveal something about yourself. So I know a lot of times we use the language that women are the survivors. Obviously, men, people who don't identify in the gender binary can also be survivors. So there's different nuances with each survivor about why they might not come forward. So for example, if a student is underage and they were using alcohol and that was a component of, you know, the interaction and of the assault, they may not want to report that because they might think, I'm going to get in trouble, you know, because I was drinking underage, or my parents are going to find that out, or if I report this to the police, you know, they'll give me a citation, you know, for underage drinking. All of which is not true, by the way. And then also, you know, with the LGBTQ community, sometimes it means coming out. So if you're on a date with someone who identifies as the same gender, who identifies as gay, lesbian, et cetera, you might have to come out in order to share that. And sometimes it's even used as blackmail. You know, if you tell anybody about this, I'm going to out you to everybody, that sort of thing. So there's lots and lots of reasons people wonder, you know, why didn't they come forward? This terrible thing happened. So all the reasons that Amy mentioned. And two, sometimes people don't know that it's happening to others, right? And so that's what we see with cases like, and we'll get into this, but Weinstein and the Nassar case, it's like, oh, other people experience this too, so I feel braver about coming forward.
And that leads kind of perfectly into kind of the next question is that, you know, finally with Harvey Weinstein and all of these accusations, we do see women coming forward and continuing to come forward, which is pretty extraordinary. And, you know, using the Me Too hashtag, which many of you may have seen on social media over the last few months. So does anyone have some thoughts about, like, I mean, you kind of just talked about it, but like what is allowing women now to come forward and share their stories?
So in terms of why women are coming forward now, you know, in Hollywood about Harvey Weinstein, because I followed this story with fascination, it was said that it was like an open secret. Everyone knew that he was a predator. You know, some women would warn other actresses, you know, don't go in a hotel room alone with him. And there were a few actresses, like if you're someone like a Meryl Streep who kind of floats above the clouds, you know, no one's going to bother you in that way. But for most women, it was if you don't, there's this casting couch culture in Hollywood. So if you don't sleep with this man or be accommodating to him, he's going to kill your career. So you won't get that next role in a film. You're going to be ostracized. There were actresses like Mira Sorvino and Rose McGowan who talked about it and basically were seen as troublemakers. And it was said that afterwards, Miramax Films that Harvey Weinstein was in control of basically blacklisted them. They were not given, they were told, you know, when a director wanted to maybe work with them, they were told, no, she's difficult. Don't work with her, she's trouble. But there was it wasn't until now where people are coming forward, because I think, again, there's safety in numbers. You feel more comfortable to say something, but for that first person to go on that limb, it's pretty darn scary. So I think as long as, like, you know, I just read even this morning on the BBC that Salma Hayek said that Harvey Weinstein threatened to break her legs if she were to come forward and say that, that he harassed her. So, I mean, you feel very powerless. He was the most powerful man in Hollywood. Everybody knew him. Everyone was afraid of him. And he was known to be a jerk. But it was seen, like, he's a culturally, he's a genius, right? He's so good at making films that we'll overlook his jerkiness and his predatorial nature because he's making these films. Now, I don't think that his films should be banned because of that, but that's been something we've been kind of talking about lately in the news. Like, you know, does the person's work, is it still relevant because of that? I think it was PBS NewsHour or on NPR, Garrison Keillor was accused of sexual harassment, and he had a show for many, many years that was, NPR was saying, we're not going to play his show anymore. We're not even going to air it. And that was something that kind of troubled me because I think, well, you know, his show was still good. People still liked it, even though that incident happened. So
we'll definitely continue to talk about that for sure.
Can you go to the second to last slide?
Yes.
So I think there's a couple things that I'd like to add. First of all, the Me Too movement is very, very powerful. Being able to empower individuals to, I don't want to call it an equalizer, but the power disparities of so many of the abusers over their victims, now this has allowed the victims to be empowered and have connection with the other survivors. A couple dynamics I wanted to touch on, I know Amy already brought up about the cultural shift. One of the times, you know, when you look at these individuals, whether they're the people in the media, whether it's the members of Congress, they almost have this superstar attitude, and the way that we treat them, the way that they're used to being treated. You know, you watch some of these members of Congress, and they have people open the door for them. They don't even... you know, if one of our members of Congress came in right now, we'd probably all turn and, you know, want to shake their hand. And I think after a while, you know, that ability of being treated that way and kind of feeling like you're above the rules. But with the cultural shift that I wanted to add to, you may know Rachel Den Hollander. She was the hero who first shared her, you know, victim story to the Indianapolis Star last August, and she really kind of set the wave for many of the other gymnasts who were victimized by Larry Nassar. And I think this quote, this is taken from an op-ed article in the New York Times from just a couple weeks ago, and I think it's very powerful. And just for the podcast, I'm going to read it aloud. In many ways, the sexual assault scandal that was 30 years ago in making was only a symptom of a much deeper cultural problem, an unwillingness to speak truth against one's own community. Predators rely on community protection to silence the victims and keep them in power. Far too often, our commitment to our political party, our religious group, our sport, our college, or a prominent member of our community causes us to choose to disbelieve or to turn away from the victim. Far too often, it feels easier and safer to see only what we want to see. And it makes me think of these campaigns of it's on us, we believe you. And, you know, to unite that together, it literally is on all of us. And sometimes we, you know, to take her theme here, may not want to see what is really there with some respected doctor, with some respected politician, the sports star. And so I think that also feeds into the culture.
And speaking of that disbelief, I kind of want to backtrack a little bit in history and time, because although this is a huge cultural movement that we're having, there have been other moments where women have, and men and others have come forward to challenge power and have faced different kinds of responses. So I think Mary, as our historian, is going to talk a little bit about some of that historical perspective.
Oops. There it is. Yeah. That's it. Thank you. I'm not going to show a clip even because we've got a lot to say here. But so some of you, most of you were probably born like when this happened. This is how I know I'm getting older, when I realized, like, oh, I was born in like 1998. Well, that was like, this was like 7 years ago before you were born. Thurgood Marshall, who was the first black Supreme Court justice appointed, retired. And so President George H.W. Bush had to appoint a new justice, and so he chose a very conservative justice by the name of Clarence Thomas, who was also black. Now, when they vet Supreme Court justice, potential Supreme Court justices, they interview everybody. Like, if they can find your kindergarten teacher, they will find your kindergarten teacher. They'll talk to everybody who knows you to find out information about you. And so when the committee then interviewed Anita Hill, who had been a law clerk under Justice Thomas, and at the time was, I'm not sure she was at University of Oklahoma yet, but she was there after, she basically testified under oath, because you have to take an oath that what you're going to say is true, that he engaged in very sexually inappropriate behavior with her. And that included talking to her about women he'd slept with. There was some very lurid, nasty talk about, and I'm sorry, pubic hairs on Coke cans. And I mean, look it up if you want to know more about that part of the story. It's very, so she had was brought before the Senate Judiciary Committee to testify about these things. And it was, you know, blasted on camera. Everyone was watching it. And she's being grilled before the Senate Judiciary Committee, which was actually chaired by Joe Biden, our former vice president. And it was basically a panel, and I'm not saying this is a negative thing, but it was a panel of all white males, older white males, basically interrogating her about this. And she had to sit there and testify about, you know, the Coke can and things like that with her family right behind her. And it turned into a he said, she said. Who was right? Who was lying? She took a polygraph test, and she passed the polygraph test, but the Senate Judiciary Committee would not allow the polygraph test to come into the evidence, because they were basically, Democrats and Republicans were kind of getting along then, and so the Democrats under Joe Biden did not want to, they kind of cut a deal with the Republicans. So ultimately they had to decide whether or not he was going to be confirmed. And he was in fact confirmed by one of the most narrow margins of justices in recent history. So, but because of this, this kind of lifted the cauldron off of this issue, because so many women then started coming forward. And it's funny, you guys, because initially, most Americans did not believe her. And a lot of women did not believe her. She's lying, she's just making this up. And again, we still don't have any concrete proof that he did it. The only thing that I will say that leads me to believe in the veracity of her story is that she was approached by them. She didn't go running to them to say, I got this story to tell, and I want to be on, you know, in People magazine and sell my story. She was approached by the committee and then under oath testified that this happened. which lends some truth to it. And so in the aftermath of that, you had a huge, as you can see on the slide, a major jump in sexual harassment cases because of this. And as time went on, as more and more women came out, when they did statistics on who believed Anita Hill, that number totally changed to the opposite, that the majority believed her, that she was not lying. And in 1992, it was referred to as the year of the woman in Congress because you had an unprecedented amount, which it's still pathetic, don't get me wrong, amount of women who ran for Congress, because we're still, what, about 23%, is it? 20% women in Congress are female. So it wasn't that great. But just the idea that so many women were galvanized to run for office, and I think you're also seeing that now in the aftermath of the allegations against President Trump and the different accusers. So that's just kind of giving you some context of how this is, because I think you guys probably sign a sexual harassment agreement when you go to work. Usually at most places of employment, you have to sign something saying, I will not engage in this. Well, that came out of this because this was happening so much and was so pervasive in the workplace. So.
Okay, bringing it back to current day. We've talked a little bit, quite a lot actually, about women's voices speaking up, the Me Too movement, which was primarily driven by women. But as Amanda said earlier, women are not the only people who face sexual harassment and assault. So I do want to talk a little bit about how men fit into the Me Too movement, both as victims and maybe as allies as well.
Right. It is important to recognize that, you know, sexual assault is something that can happen to anyone at any age, at any gender. Okay. So when the Me Too movement was going, Anthony Rapp, who has done a lot of Broadway work, but is recently in the new Star Trek series, he came out about Kevin Spacey, that Kevin Spacey, a famous actor from House of Cards, had engaged in inappropriate sexual behavior with Anthony Rapp when he was a minor. And these were the kinds of responses that Anthony Rapp was getting. We kind of agree, what the H were you doing waiting in his room until everyone left, et cetera. You were just scared and didn't understand homo feelings. Hashtag Lolito. If you're familiar with Lolita, it's a story about a young girl who engages in sexual activity. And so they were kind of calling him the male version of that, right? That it was his fault, that he was complicit in it. Then this person commented that the Spacey story could have waited one season for us fans. How would you like if Star Trek gets ruined because someone there was a perv 30 years ago? So House of Cards was more important than somebody's mental and emotional well-being. That's exciting. But this is, not to sound too sarcastic, but this is the kind of stuff that victims are hearing and why they're less likely to come forward. Mm-hmm. This person used a lot of really vulgar language, but talked about, you conveniently come out with this nonsense while Harvey Weinstein is big in the news, you know, and said that you took this opportunity. Well, like we just talked about, sometimes people come forward because there is more attention to the issue, right? People are more likely to come forward when there's that other support, when people are saying things like, we're believing these survivors and everything like that. And for Anthony Rapp in particular, as a male victim, there was a lot of homophobic, hate-centric language about, you know, just the fact that, you know, he's gay as well and that kind of thing. So it, that was something I wanted to mention too, was that idea of intersectionality, how it can be difficult for survivors, any survivor anyway, but lots of things make that different or more difficult, or just add a nuance to it. So everything from, you know, your gender, men are less likely to come forward even, because there's this idea of masculinity where you should have been strong enough to say no, or, you know, what man wouldn't want to have sex? So, you know, how could a woman have raped you? You know, that sort of thing. Again, we kind of talked about the LGBT community. And, you know, that idea of power and money as well. It might be easier to come forward if you already have millions of dollars in the bank versus if you're a minimum wage worker in a restaurant, right? But anyway, I just, you know, I thought these were you know, interesting posts from Anthony Rapp, and I did, even though they're public, ask his permission before sharing them, because he has done a lot in sharing his story and being very brave and sharing these responses, because obviously it's a very painful thing for him to go through. But to that point about, you know, why people are coming forward and, you know, is it a men's issue or not? The Me Too, and this is the last thing I'll say, the Me Too movement maybe isn't specifically for male survivors, but it certainly is for male comrades and allies, right? So just because the Me Too movement is focused more on women survivors, people who identify as women coming forward, that doesn't mean that there's not a place for men in that. It's just this particular movement isn't about that. Similar to how, you know, in Black Lives Matter, if you identify as white, you can be an ally or a comrade, but this isn't time for your voice. This isn't time for necessarily your stories and experiences. I'm done now.
Are you, do you guys want to go? I don't want to, like, do you want to leave me?
Go ahead.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. So, kind of piggybacking off what Amanda said, I think it, one of the things that we talked about that I mentioned when we had talked about this, our conversation on Friday, was just the idea that I think that some of these conversations need to be prefaced by this idea that, first of all, it's okay to have this conversation. So, in when I'm in, I teach history, and we talk a lot about race, and I notice that oftentimes white students get uncomfortable because there's almost like this feeling of, why am I being blamed for things that happened, you know, 150 years ago? I didn't do that. It's not my fault. And I sense the same kinds of feelings coming out when we have this conversation, even about sexual harassment or sexual assault, where I think kind of men might feel, this is all on me. I didn't do this. This is not, you know. So I think if we start there under the premise that, you know, no one's talking about you. You're good. Unless you're doing it yourself, you're okay. But I read a quote from a black author in The Guardian that I thought was really powerful. And he said that, you know, you're not responsible for what happened 150 years ago. But if you don't do anything about what happens in the next 20 years and you're complicit in it, or you don't speak out against it, or you don't learn anything from it, then you are you know, then you are more responsible for it. And I thought that was a good way of kind of encapsulating that. So just thought I'd throw that out there.
Just one other thing I'd add is, you know, I think for men, they're like, oh, you know, sometimes I hear men will say, oh, you know, wow, this is happening so much. So I would challenge any men to ask their women friends or their, you know, sisters or cousins or whoever, ask them if they've experienced it. I don't know any woman who has not experienced some kind of harassment. I mean, that's how common it is. And so I think it's important for men to understand that this is really ubiquitous, that it's happening all the time, every day, to anybody who identifies as female. And that's a really important point, because I don't think we realize how big of an issue it is, that we have a culture that's set up that allows or accepts the idea that it's okay to comment on women's bodies, it's okay to joke around, kind of, you know, quote unquote joke around with women about certain topics. And I think most women would say, well, you know, I've kind of laughed it off, or I've kind of, you know, whatever, that's how that person is. And we kind of make excuses for people. And so are part of the problem in a sense. So I think we all need to look at the role that we play in the way this is happening.
To piggyback off of Amy now, I debated whether or not I would share this, but I decided to share it just because, to give, you know, as Amy said, it's so pervasive, it happens all the time. And I think all of us kind of excuse it and think it's no big deal. I had an incident that happened to me years ago when I was studying abroad in Greece, two incidences that happened actually, and I kind of almost forgot about them until the stories with Donald Trump had resurfaced. But the first incident that happened, I was at a Greek Independence Day parade in downtown Athens, and the crowd was like super, just, you couldn't move. There were so many people, and so you were just kind of like in a situation where if you're claustrophobic, you would not have wanted to be there. And there was a man behind me who like pressed up against me and pressed me to the person in front of me, and I couldn't move, who was essentially masturbating against me. It took me a couple seconds. I'm like, is that what I think it is? Oh, yeah, that's what I think it is. So, and I sat there frozen. And for that reason alone, I can empathize with assault survivors who wrote in this book about how just they froze, they didn't know what to do, and they know, why didn't they fight back? Well, because you're taken, you're under such shock, that I think you almost kind of detach. I mean, even with this incident, which is not anywhere near sexual assault, so I want to make sure I'm not in any way comparing myself to that, but just to give you the idea that you do feel like, you know, it took me about 10, 15 seconds to finally try to kind of elbow this guy, because I was so taken aback by it. But it's one of those things, well, it happens. And then I was followed by a weird old Greek guy. And I'm Greek, so I'll get away with saying that he was a very, very weird, nasty old Greek guy. You could say it too, it's fine. Who followed me on the subway and was saying just really very sexual things, half of which I didn't understand in Greek, thank God. But he was following me, and he followed me off the subway. And it totally freaked me out. I didn't want him to see where I lived, so I just ran into like a Greek Radio Shack that was on the corner and ran in there. And then he just went away because the men were like, I'm like, this guy's following me. And they're like, who, that guy? And he like had his face like pressed against the door. They're like, get out of here. So he took off. But I was scared after that for the rest of the time I lived in Greece because I was afraid to walk home alone. I didn't want this guy to see where I lived. And you know, you shouldn't have to feel afraid. That's not normal. But I kind of thought that it was. I just didn't think about it until now, until I heard a story on NPR right after the women had come forward about Donald Trump, about a woman who said that just on her way to the NPR studio in New York, she got harassed twice on the subway. And so that it happens, as Amy said, constantly. But we cannot just excuse it and say that there's nothing wrong with that, that it's okay, this is just what happens.
Right, and I think, thank you for sharing, because I do think that when we diminish it and say, oh, it wasn't that big of a deal, like that helps keep this culture pervasive. And it's hard because I think you do want to say, well, it's not as bad, because both it's a coping mechanism, like I didn't have to go through something as horrible as someone else. But it's also, you know, a coping mechanism, but also a way that we allow that thing to continue, mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah, and I just wanted to acknowledge too, you know, thank you for sharing your story, because that does, you know, take bravery. And I wanted to point out one of the things you talked about was that kind of freezing response. So, you know, I think it's important when people hear victims and survivors' stories and they think, well, why didn't you, you know, do this or that or the other thing? You know, we as human beings have this sort of just world way of looking at things. So if you ever hear about bad misfortune for somebody else, especially like someone you don't know very well, like on the news or something, and you're like, well, that's not going to happen to me because I would have done this. I would have remembered to unplug, you know, the curling iron. I would have remembered to lock my door, that kind of thing. And it's how we keep ourselves safe. This isn't going to happen to me. But like we've talked about it, it can happen. The other thing I want people to understand is that trauma resides in very instinctual parts of your brain. You literally aren't given a choice how to respond. So, for example, how many of you have been driving and been startled by a car pulling out in front of you or a horn honking or something like that, right? Well, why'd you get startled? You didn't get hit. Nothing bad happened, right? But it's because your brain automatically puts into place, you know, different things to help you as an organism survive. So that kind of, you know, fight, flight, or freeze response is very much and often what we see in victims and survivors. It's a response to trauma. So it's just really important to not judge how survivors handle that trauma, because a lot of that, again, is on a cellular level. So.
And talking about rape culture, the things that allow this to happen, allow us to diminish it, allow it to continue, speak a lot to the messages that we get growing up that are really confusing about gender roles, about sexuality. They're pervasive from the time we're real little and influence the way we act with each other and the way we hear survivors. So, you know, we talked about Harvey Weinstein, Larry Nassar. These are very obvious breaches of justice. I mean, they're horrific and they're very identifiable once they're out in the world, right? But then we start to have conversations about actors like Aziz Ansari, who, I don't know if you all heard, was accused of coercion on a date. And you know, then there's this question of how are those things related? How does rape culture enable both of those things to happen? And what do we do to make sure people feel safe? So I wanted to throw out to the panel, like, a little bit maybe more of defining what is rape culture and what makes these conversations so difficult to have, and how do we see Aziz Ansari as, you know, part of a continuum with Harvey Weinstein?
Well, and I want other people to respond to this more than me, but I just want to make one quick point, as Tish mentioned, coercion. And we'll get into the Moraine's policy and institutional responses later, but it's really important to understand the difference between coercion and consent. So people might have thought, you know, and first of all, I like Aziz Ansari. I think he's funny. I really like his work. But in reading about what had happened, people were very confused about, well, he didn't really, you know, he didn't force her. He didn't have a weapon. He didn't, you know, we've all been on dates like that, that again, that kind of normalization. So it's just important to understand that coercion is about when you convince somebody past the point where they don't want to give consent, but they give in and give it anyway. And sometimes coercion can be forceful, like if you don't do this, I'm going to hit you. If you don't do this, you know, whatever. In this case, it seemed more like he was just not listening to the clear signals, and that's why the activity happened. He did not get free consent. He did not get, you know, affirmation, continued affirmation. So I just want to make sure that people understand that that's the difference in that case, but other folks can respond about the culture.
Yeah, you can put the slide on. So, yeah, okay, that one first. Okay, so this kind of sums up rape culture. Okay, so when you go away to school and you see this sign hanging on campus, okay, you know, I don't know how you feel about it. You might think, oh, it's funny, it's a joke, no big deal. But these kinds of things are what keep rape culture going. Oh, that's kind of funny. Well, they had to take the sign down. But if you look at this other kind of this Twitter feed here, you know, if you wear more clothes, you're harder to rape. That's the only problem, right? Women just aren't wearing enough clothes. I mean, again, blaming the victim. These are ridiculous. Tish, if you want to put the rape culture. So anyway, this is just kind of a graphic to look at what is rape culture. Rape culture starts off with this normalization process that, well, boys will be boys, you know, blaming the victim. After early on in the campaign when the Access Hollywood tape came out with President Trump, one of the biggest comments was, well, that's locker room talk. If you guys remember that comment, locker room talk. That somehow it's okay when men are saying this to each other because it's just something that, you know, that's what men do and we have to accept it and be okay with it. But then you also look at things like sexist attitude and unequal pay and just kind of these other overarching structures. Revenge porn, all these other kinds of things, catcalling. I mean, how many women in here have ever had an unsolicited comment about themselves? I mean, is there anybody who hasn't? You know, it's just how we are unfortunately socialized, and then you kind of move up the chain here on the pyramid, and then you see things like threatening, condom removal, groping, and then obviously at the top, you know, rape and more explicit kinds of violence that happen. And so, if we look at this, we say, I mean, if you look at that grid, you say, is that the world we live in? I mean, I guess that's the question. Would you guys agree that this is kind of the world we live in? Yeah, right? And this is what rape culture is. So we all participate in it. We're all part of it. And any woman that experiences these things, rape or violence against them, is really, it helps to keep women in their place. Part of what, how the structure functions is that women are, you know, that are harassed or something like that. Other women come out and say, well, we don't know if we believe them or look what she was wearing. So women participate in it too. I don't want to make it like this is something that men are doing to women. We all participate in this culture. And I think that one of the other things that we have to acknowledge is that sexualized violence against women is seen as okay in the media. If you go back once, so on the bottom, I don't know if you guys can see it. I have the link to the Blurred Lines music video. Everybody remember Blurred Lines, you know? And okay, that whole thing in 2013, and people were like, "Oh, this is a catchy song." I was singing it. I'm like, "Yeah, you know, this is a good song." And then when I'm listening to the words, I'm like, "Whoa." Yeah, I mean, basically, it was a song about women being raped. Yeah, I mean, coercing women into sex, and that's okay. And, you know, you probably all have it on your playlist at some point, right? Because it just was an up, you know, kind of a good tune. But there was a lot of people writing about that song afterwards saying, hey, you know, this might be a little problem with this. And they got backlash for it. People are like, Oh, come on. It's just a song. It's no big deal. You're making a big deal out of nothing. And there was a lot of pushback on it. And then it just kind of went away. And now with this whole, you know, Me Too movement coming up, I've read some people talking about, like, this was the beginning, this blurred lines, you know, 6 years ago or whatever it was. I feel like I'm going off on a tangent. But anyway, that, so that kind of rape culture encompasses all of this. The music you watch, the media that you consume, all of those things are part of it.
I just, the culture that we've been talking about is very important. I think that diagram that she had up there is also very helpful. How many of you are familiar with Aziz Ansari and that story? Could you just put a raise of hands if people are familiar with this story? Can somebody describe it? Do you feel comfortable?
Sure. So for those of you who don't know about the Aziz Ansari is a comedian. He has a show, which for some reason I always try to call Modern Love, but it's not. It's
Man of the
Master of None, which got a lot of accolades critically. And he was recently accused in a piece on a website, its name I cannot remember.
Babe.net.
By a woman who went on a date with him. And, like, they went on a date. It was going okay. They went back to his place. And she, you know, they started engaging in some intimate behavior. And at some point she's like, all right, I'm good. Like, let's just hang out. And they, like, moved to his couch, and he continued to push her for sexual favors. And at no point, I think as Amanda mentioned, did he, you know, use physical force, but it was this persistent, you know, asking for particular things. And she kept saying no, like, not really into it, no thanks, but he kept going. So eventually she gave in because she's on a date, and, like, we're all socialized, not we're all. Many women, I think, especially, are socialized to, you know, be accommodating, be nice, and that extends to our dates as well as other places in society. So this is the conversation that then gets put into the media, and I think that's where the debate happens, is we want to define rape as this horrible thing that happens, and it's the Harvey Weinsteins of the world who, you know, are the ones perpetuating it, but rape culture actually impacts all of us, all of the dates that we go on. It sets standards for behavior, and we need to be talking about it. Like, what is, as Amanda defined, coercion? What does that look like on a date? When do you get to say no and just say, let's stop this? So,
and I would urge you to read, I think her name, she goes by Grace, it's anonymous, but she writes about the date. I would urge you to actually read her version of it, because I do think that that's helpful, because there's been a lot of media coverage of this, positive and negative, and many people are taking excerpts. And it wasn't until just last week after our conversation that I read it in full myself, and it did change my opinion. But everything that has been said, I agree with. I just, I want to share two quotes. One is from Matt Damon, and he had made this comment in an interview that there's a difference between patting somebody on the butt in rape and child molestation. That prompted Minnie Driver. If you guys have seen Good Will Hunting, they were co-stars. Minnie Driver said, no, you don't get to be hierarchical about this, about abuse. And I believe they dated, so they probably have some history together. So I don't know all of that history. But there, you know, there's part of me with the Matt Damon version, you know, for me, in my worldview, the top of this is very different than the bottom of this. And on top of that, the Aziz Ansari story is I've had a lot of really fascinating conversations about it with friends, with students, but I just, in some ways, I don't know how transferable it is to the average dating situation. I mean, there are some elements of it that are, you know, there was three different moments of oral sex, and, you know, I think in some ways he was not picking up on cues and misread the vibe between them. But in other ways, you know, they met at a Grammy party or something like that. And, you know, so he's famous, and there's a lot of things that are just not transferable to the average kind of dating situation. But, you know, I'm interested in conversations like this and your own opinions about how this fits in. And when Minnie Driver says you don't get to be hierarchical about this abuse, it makes me very hesitant to say anything, so maybe I should stop. But I want you to know that this is just my opinion, and maybe I don't get to have an opinion on this. But to me, the Me Too movement is more about the top part of this and less about this part of it. In this, well, I mean, we're talking about the culture. It's important to talk. I mean, all of this is feeding in. That was my initial comment. I believe the culture is important, and I believe this dating situation is important. But typically, movements are more successful when they're focused, when they're tightly focused, and they have a specific agenda and outcome in mind of what this movement is going to accomplish. And sometimes when you start adding a lot of other related, but not quite the same situations, you can dilute the power of that movement. And that concerns me. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to cite a feminist, also a legal scholar, Zephyr Teachout. And she wrote an article, op-ed piece saying, "I'm not convinced Al Franken should quit." So it's a slightly different topic, but she points out that zero tolerance should go hand in hand with two other things, due process and proportionality. Due process means a fair, full investigation with the chance of the accused to respond, and proportionality means that while all forms of inappropriate sexual behavior should be addressed, the response should be based on the nature of the transgressions. And so the Me Too movement's very powerful. I said that earlier about allowing the victims, the powerless, to be able to have a voice. But when we're using social media and only a version of this comes out and we're kind of all jury, judge, and executioner, there's some downsides. And I think the downsides, and I think it was her that referenced this, you start losing mothers and sisters, moms who have boys. There's a bigger movement that could lose momentum because now all of a sudden you're lump summing the people on the lower end of their transgressions with the people who are the Harvey Weinsteins and the Nassers, and that kind of cloudiness can make the movement murky.
So one of the things I want to pull out of that is that I think there's a difference between what the media does with this information and what we do conversationally in our classes and with each other. And I think one of the important things to keep in mind, and I read this and heard some people talking about it at one point, so I'll credit them, not myself, for thinking this, but what is important about these conversations is that, like, as we're looking at, rape culture leads up to those bigger things. So I don't think, like, the woman who came forward about Aziz Ansari wasn't asking for him to be fired. She wasn't asking for monetary compensation. She wasn't asking for anything at all other than just that was her story and to be believed, which is a very different thing than someone coming forward about Harvey Weinstein, right, who is clearly made egregious, like law-breaking actions, and he needs to be prosecuted for those. So there is a difference, I think, in women telling their stories. And a lot of the Me Too stories that I've read aren't the kinds of stories where you're going to go and, like, put someone in jail. It's just, this happened to me. I need you to hear it. Mm-hmm. I need you to know that this is a thing I do, like, I endure every day. Mm-hmm. And so I think us maintaining that nuance is really important because all of those stories, I think, deserve to be told. What we do with them as a society, I think, is going to then either shift or not shift the power dynamics between men and women and how we handle rape culture.
Right. And I don't think they have to be mutually exclusive. I came across a quote from The Guardian, and I'll just read you a brief part of it. She says, "Women like me do not feel the need to preface our feminism with reassuring words for men. It shouldn't need to be said that men are key feminist allies, nor do we favor a witch hunt. You can be a feminist and defend rape suspects, as I did, as a criminal defense lawyer. A justice system run by more women," I'm adding that in there, "would look very different, which is why it's important to advocate relentlessly for more gender equality at its senior levels." That ties into the power dynamic. And us talking before about, you know, since 1992, we're still at about 20% of our US Congress are made up of females. And that may not seem like, you may say, well, you know, a man can advocate for women's things too. They can. It's just, but we're all socialized based on our experiences. And so what's more likely that, you know, maybe an older man who has maybe never experienced that, will he be able to kind of give that the same justice and attention that a woman who's actually experienced it would? Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of it too, this idea that's part of the equation that we need to be talking about more, and how do we encourage women to run for office. And I think that's why the Access Hollywood, Donald Trump thing, and then now Harvey Weinstein, all that, is awakening kind of an anger. And maybe that's why I think we are kind of, you know, you're going the opposite direction with this idea of Aziz Ansari too, and equating them, because there are degrees of things. You know, what happened to me is not sexual assault. It's groping, it's on that pyramid, but that's not the same thing. But we don't have to, we can walk and chew gum at the same time, as Bill Maher was saying on Real Time with Bill Maher. We can do both. We can say that both are wrong and maybe address them in different ways.
And I think what Kevin and Mary are saying is really important. And I think one, and Tish as well, one of the key phrases from Kevin's that I want to pick up is the idea of due process. And I need you all to hear that here at Maureen there is due process. So me standing up here, or sitting up here, and talking about all these different things about rape culture and trauma and everything like that, that does not mean that when respondents, and that's the term we use for people who have been accused of, you know, these things, that they're not treated fairly, that they're not listened to, that they're not given due process. Due process is extremely important here for federal laws, and because, hi, that's ethical. And when people talk about, well, I believe in the Me Too movement because I have sisters or daughters or a wife or whatever, I sometimes struggle with that, because I treat respondents well because they're people and they're students and they have rights. You know, I don't treat them well because I have a brother who I love dearly, which is true. And I, if, you know, goodness forbid he was accused of something like that, I would want him to have somebody like me, but someone who is fair and just and interested in due process, okay? So it's just very important to me that people hear that my role is to be the objective third party who is making that decision. And that's difficult on this level. Can you imagine what that's like in the court system when there is so much attention and so many people on their Twitter going, well, I think he's definitely guilty or she's definitely a liar. You know, it's multiplied here as well. And I wanna say one other thing along with that and with our process. No one is ever going to come to a counselor or a responsible employee or a Title IX coordinator at this school and be told, well, what happened to you isn't as big of a deal. That's never going to happen. It may mean that there is a different sanction levied, right, for the respondent if they're found responsible. But I don't want anyone to ever feel, you know, well, I'm not gonna share this, or if I do share it, I'm not gonna have the same attention. Getting patted on the butt can have the same traumatic response in your body as being sexually assaulted. And by definition, there are things that people say, oh, that wasn't sexual assault. Yes, it was, you know, by the lawful definition in Illinois. You know, it depends on your state and everything too. But anyway, I just wanted those 2 points to, you know, to go out there, since students are listening, that we do have that due process, and that we respond to each instance with the same amount of seriousness, if not the same severity of sanction.
Amanda, do you want to show off the Title IX?
Yeah,
info?
If you want to bring that up, that would be great. So so who's heard the term Title IX before? Me, good. Okay, yeah. So Title IX has been around for years, actually, but it basically guarantees gender equality, you know, in school. So a lot of people know Title IX because of sports, right? Like if there's, you know, funding for a male sports team, you have to have funding for a female sports team, that sort of thing. Recently with, oh goodness, lots of stuff may just come to light more recently, but because of the, you know, recent focus on campuses and assaults and things that were happening on campuses and going unreported or unsanctioned, you know, there's a lot more federal guidelines with this. So if you go to the Maureen site and click on Right to Know, and this is a good thing to know about anyway, there's all sorts of things that you as students have a right to know. And over on the left, you'll see Title IX. You can also get to this on the Maureen Valley portal. And we have pamphlets over there too that have the kind of short version of this, because the sexual discrimination, harassment, misconduct policy, with all my notes in it, is pretty lengthy, right? But it is good to read through so you know. But a couple things I did want to highlight on here or with this policy. One is where to find it, right? You can find it on the site, on the portal, counseling center, Title IX office, the conduct office, we all have hard copies of it. And all faculty and staff are required to be trained on this. So all of your, you know, professors and everything should know about it. A couple of roles to know. And I'll again, just kind of summarize this. We have a Title IX coordinator, Dr. Joanne Jenkins, and she's located over in G Building. So she is the individual responsible for making sure that we're compliant with all of the Title IX federal guidelines and everything like that. And she also obviously hears and resolves cases. A lot of people think, again, about this as, you know, sexual harassment, discrimination, misconduct, that's what it's called. But it also has to do with gender identity. So, for example, if you have a preferred name and someone, you know, a professor or staff member refuses to call you by that name, that would be discrimination. If you're a pregnant or parenting student, you also have rights and protections. All of that falls under this. But anyway, Joanne's, Dr. Jenkins' contact is up there. There's Dr. Jenkins, the president, and then Dr. Jenkins, the Title IX coordinator. So just FYI, they're two different people. Oh, thank you so much. So this is what the little pamphlets over there look like. Again, it kind of shortens our process, gives resources for on-campus counseling, off-campus counseling, talks about some different measures that you should know, and I'll summarize those real quickly. Obviously, the Moraine Valley Police on campus are another resource for students wanting to report. Keep in mind that they and faculty and staff are not are called responsible employees, not just because we're responsible people who do our jobs, but that means that we have to report. It doesn't mean that you have to go to the police or that we're going to call your parents or we're going to, you know, call the person you're accusing and saying, hey, this person came in and accused you. It just means that we have to report it to the Title IX coordinator, okay? If you want to speak to somebody confidentially about it, we have the counseling center. By law, we're required to have one confidential advisor, but several of, like, all the counselors are able to help with this kind of issue, but several are also trained to be that. But Suzanne Nasser is our confidential advisor. But if you go to counseling and want to talk to somebody, it's completely confidential, okay? You can report online, you can report in person, you can report anonymously. And this covers all of the Moraine community. That includes if somebody comes onto our campus, like let's say we have a speaker come onto campus. They can't do anything on this campus either, and nothing can be done to them as far as this policy goes, right? If you live off campus with another student and something happens, Title IX can also apply to that. So the jurisdiction of it is pretty wide. Let's see. I want to talk really briefly about with the process as well. Like I said, there's due process, so both parties get a chance to share their story if you want an investigation to move forward. Both parties have a chance to share their story with the Title IX investigator or with the coordinator. The two people are, you know, two or sometimes it involves more. They're never in a room together. So the survivor never has to face the accused person. That's a really important law protecting that. It's confidential. We don't call faculty and say, oh, this is going on. We don't call, like I said, we don't call parents, family, that sort of thing. There can also be interim measures. So if you have a class with that person or you just, you know, see them on campus a lot, we can put in no contact orders into place. We can arrange class schedules to be different, that sort of thing. So there are a lot of interim measures. Sometimes people are afraid to come forward because they're like, you know, I'm worried that once they know that I accuse them, they're going to come after me. We have a lot about retaliation, no contact, all sorts of interim measures. We also have amnesty policies. So like I mentioned earlier, if somebody doesn't want to come forward because they're like, well, I was drinking, or, you know, we weren't supposed to be sneaking off on this school trip and we did anyway, we don't worry about that. We're going to focus on the Title IX issue, right? And then both parties are made aware of the outcome and both parties have a right to appeal. So let's say, you know, we put them on probation and you think they should be suspended, you can appeal that. Or let's say they got suspended and they don't think, you know, that should happen, they can appeal that. So both parties have the chance to appeal, which is an important right as well. So currently, I don't know if anybody's familiar with Betsy DeVos and the Department of Education. There are some changes that have been suggested. Currently, Maureen's stuff is not changing. So everything that's online now, that's always going to be the most updated version. You know, but I guess the important thing we want you all to know is that we do have that due process. You can come and report and, you know, have it be kept confidential or not move forward, you know, just depending on the circumstances. But we also have information about rights for respondents, so people who've been accused. By law, we have to provide the same treatment and rights and resources to respondents that we do to complainants. So that's important to know as well. And I think that's all I wanted to say about the policy. But just so you know that there is that institutional response from Moraine of zero tolerance.
And I think we could keep talking up here for a really long time, but we have about 15 minutes left, and we would really like to take some of your questions or comments. If there are things that you'd like to chime in about this conversation, we'd like to talk to you. And Troy should have a microphone, I think. No, Troy doesn't have a microphone. But he will. So if you raise your hand, please wait for Troy to find you with the microphone.
Don't be afraid to ask questions. Someone's got to be the first one, like we were just talking about. So someone's got to do it.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Way to go.
So the last time I checked, there's only 12 counselors on campus, and there's a lot of students on the campus. So how do you guys plan to, you know, accommodate everyone?
That's a great question, and I wonder if the counselors want to respond to it. Do you mean accommodate everyone as far as, could you clarify that part? Do you mean accommodate everyone as far as,
yeah.
as far as what, dear?
As far as, like, you know, people who come in, you know, with any situation or problem.
Okay, that's a good question, and I'll, yeah, we'll defer to them.
Hi, I'm Tracy, one of the time counselors here. We do have 12 counselors on campus. Very good question. Obviously, as a counselor, we would want to have, like, one counselor for every 10 of you. That is not fiscally possible. But do know that if you ever have any need, we have a counselor available for drop-in every hour that we're in business, every hour that we're open. If you have any concerns about anybody besides yourself, you are welcome to come in and talk to us as well. We do not have a waiting list. Waiting list.
But you could always use for counselors, so it's on our.
We can hear most of it. Do we want to switch out hers?
Okay. Other questions? Good question.
I was wondering if you all wouldn't mind to comment on the idea around explicit consent. I think we've covered kind of like gray area situations. And I wonder if you all had thoughts about the idea of explicit consent as far as interactions between people.
So to pull from the Moraine policy, and the definition of consent goes on for a couple of pages. But to summarize that, so consent has to be clear and knowing and voluntary words or actions that give permission to engage in mutually agreed upon sexual activity. Doesn't that sound hot, right? I know that people, like Tish is wearing her consent is sexy shirt. I know that people sometimes, I think Dave Chappelle did a sketch on it, like, are you supposed to have somebody sign a contract every move you make in the bedroom or the living room or wherever you are? And no, that's certainly not the idea, right? But if you're not getting that, yes, if you're not getting those, you know, physical movements and that sort of thing, the nonverbal signals, then you no longer have consent. And obviously it goes too into, you know, about people who are intoxicated can't give consent. People who are not cognitively aware cannot give consent. People who are underage, et cetera. So it is worth reading so that you do understand, kind of like we were talking about Aziz Ansari, like, you know, the difference between coercion and consent. But yeah, does that, I don't know if anybody has more to share on that.
Well, and just speaking to explicit and enthusiastic consent, there's been a number, because of the Me Too movement, I think I've been reading a lot of op-eds and women talking about their own experiences. And the most recent one I read that I thought was really important, and I'll try to find it and make it available to people, was about how often women experience pain during sex. And if your partner is experiencing pain but feels like they need to, like, accommodate you or make you happy, like, that's a problem, right? And if, and again, I think this is speaking to rape culture, we have this idea that, like, guys are supposed to, like, you know, get sex however they can. And if it means coercion, okay. But think about how you actually want to have sex, right? Like, it should be fun. It should be with a partner who, like, is up for it too. Like, that's awesome. So this whole t-shirt consent is sexy, totally can be. So let's make it sexy.
Other questions?
Okay, just a maybe an easy question and then a comment. The follow-up question about the counseling staff. So there's 12 full-time counselors. Are there any? No, there's not 12 full-time counselors.
Six and six. Six full-time.
12 counselors. Yeah, I was going to ask, are there vacancies? Are there full-time vacancies that need to be filled? That's my perhaps not so easy question, but it sounds easy when I say it. And my comment was for you, Kevin. I know that I appreciate the comment that you made about the challenges in your speaking up on this topic. You felt, I got the sense that you felt hesitant to have an opinion, as you said, but I appreciate the way that you articulated yourself, and I do think it's important that everybody can speak up and participate in the dialogue, even if we have to be careful about how we step and we can qualify our statements and so forth, but I think it's important that everybody has a voice and nobody feels or is made to feel left out. So thank you for your comments.
Agreed.
Oh, you have a question over here too. You got a question over here too.
How can I say this? We have been short a full-time counselor because one of our full-time counselors left at the beginning of this past fall semester, and it was something that was unforeseen by administration. So we are down a full-time counselor. But we've also had seven full-time counselors for over 20 years and have not had an increase. Now, we do have more adjuncts, and we love our adjuncts because they are in a crucial part of it. But the reality is mental health crises and mental health concerns are just going up across all schools. So we're doing our best. I think we're doing a pretty darn good job given our resources. But, you know, we can't, you know, fiscally it's difficult. But students have a lot of voice here. You guys have more voice than little me. So, you know, if you have any concerns about anything besides if it's around counseling staff or anybody, you need to go to the administrators to talk to them about your concerns. But you got to have the facts. You got to have the real deal. They're not going to listen to you didn't like how somebody talked to you. But here's what I try to do, and this is my experience. That's going to get anything if you want any changes. And that's true for anything in society, by the way.
Question over here too, Troy.
Okay, come on. If we're add librarians to the list, we'll take a couple more librarians while we're asking.
We'll send a petition around in a minute.
Thank you. Question for the panel. So I think recently a lot of people have been shocked by how many accusations have happened against congressmen and senators. I think mostly because we look up to them as people in our government and important figures to us as a part of American culture. What would you on the panel like to see better done through legislation to help repercussions happen because of this, or to even potentially make a future where we can prevent this kind of behavior from happening?
So the slide that was up here that's about the change is just talking about the institutional, the context of the institution. So to your point, we've referenced several times about how 20% of Congress is female. And any guesses as to where that stacks up internationally? My comparative government class knows. I'm 99, and we're 99th, and you know, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and several other surprise countries are ahead of us. And so to your point, what can we do differently? One is, you know, Mary mentioned the Year of the Woman in 1992. We do have a record number of candidates for office this year. And really, as Illinois voters at all levels of government, not all levels with the president, but with our House of Representative race, with our governor race, attorney general, you know, when you have 20% of an institution, I think there's three things that come to mind. One is the lack of laws that are, to Mary's point, in the spirit and full interests of women. And what's up on the screen is a video. We're not going to play it due to time, but this was the process in Congress. I want to call it process. There's better words to call this. But this would take at least 6 months for an individual. So let's say you're a staffer. So by the way, many of the, half of all personnel in Congress are females, but most of the personnel, lower position, lower paid and lower ranking positions are female, and some of the higher staffer positions are male. So you've got just this gender context where the men generally have the power and women don't. So having more women in Congress would be helpful, A, for legislation to eradicate situations like this. Now, on Tuesday, the House of Representatives voted to significantly change this process. That's a step in the right direction. I guarantee it wouldn't have happened without the Me Too movement. The other thing that more women in power does is, in addition to just changing the context of the institution and getting more legislation that is in the interest of women, would also be, just think of young kids looking up to positions of power like Congress. And I think it was Oprah was talking about Sidney Poitier and what that did for her image of what she could do in her life. And so it shows to our young girls, that they too can be in positions of power. So we need to vote. And it's not to say that a male can't have the interests of a female at heart, but this unrepresentativeness all across the, it's in CEOs, it's in state level government. One of the slides I had showed for every women in office, there's three males, and that's just across the board, mm-hmm. state level government. So I think that voters need to change.
I think what's interesting about this is that it's the most bipartisan issue that we've had in like maybe decades, right? This is happening, and it's not just Republicans, not just Democrats, it's everybody. And what I was going to say before, that's why your question is so timely, is that I think we are doing our young women a disservice, because we, unless we are encouraging them more, and there are more institutions out there that there's, and I can't remember which there's a place in Illinois where they're trying to, they're giving women support and teaching them how to run. What do you need to do to get a campaign off the ground? So that's one thing that's happening as a result of Me Too. It was fascinating that at the Women's March last year, there were 250,000 people. This year, there were 300,000. And I did go, but I was thinking, oh, there are not going to be that many people here, But I'm going to go, I'll show up. But I was shocked at how many more people there were. So that does suggest that this is not just going to go away quietly. But we have to teach, and I think for young women, a lot of times we feel the pressure of, if you have children, if you don't have good daycare services, how are you going to run if you're in your 30s or you're in your early 40s and you're working and you've got young, how are you going to do that? It's really hard to do that. So that kind of goes part and parcel. Other European countries where the level of female participation is much higher have those nets in place where you have affordable daycare and places to send your children so that you can work and do those things. We don't have that in place here, and that's something that we need to be talking about more.
To Mary's point, one of the studies I came across showed that one out of 15 men, women are 15 times more likely to not run for office due to childcare, that they are the primary caretakers. And one other point, Abby, that you brought up about legislation that we should keep our eye on. So it's ending Forced Arbitration of Sexual Harassment Act of 2017. So in many private businesses, you sign an agreement when you become an employee to essentially go through arbitration. Forced arbitration, which often leads to non-disclosure agreements. Look into this legislation. There's Republicans and Democrats working on it. So this is another one to contact your elected official about.
I know we're almost out of time. I would give a quick plug if you wanted to make a change in elected officials. Emily's List is a website, and they advocate and raise money to give to women candidates, female candidates, and it's started in 1992. From the Anita Hill issue, so that's a place where you can help make a difference.
All right, thank you to these panelists. So please continue this conversation amongst yourselves. There's a lot of work to be done. And don't be afraid, as Mike said, to maybe disagree with your friends. Have conversations and talk it out. It's the only way we're going to get change. So thank you.